to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's past. Mark Levenier, your host for this hour of True History. Later on, episodes of Adventures in Research and That Was the Year. But first, it's The March of Time, one of the top five earliest surviving broadcasts from the CBS series, which was also seen on the silver screen before major motion pictures, from April 5th, 1935.
The March of Time. On a thousand fronts, the history of the world moves swiftly forward. A thousand new facts, new details in the world's history come into being every hour. There is one complete record of this swift-changing civilization.
It is Time, the weekly news magazine.
Time makes it possible for the busy man to read the story of his lifetime as he lives the story of his life. Discover Time. It's on every newsstand. The new issue is out today. It's the magazine with the red border.
And now, the March of Time on the screen. The second issue is now showing in 1,000 U.S. theaters. If you've not seen it, watch your newspapers for your local announcements. You will find the March of Time a new experience in the motion picture theater. Presenting in word and picture the whole story. The hidden beginnings, the play-by-play developments, the dramatic climaxes of the world's news events.
Tonight, the editors of Time raise the curtain again on their new kind of reporting of the news. The reenacting of memorable scenes from the news of the week. From the March of Time.
England must realize that only Germany stands between Europe and Soviet Russia. Germany must have an army of 1 million men to prevent the Red Forces of the Soviets from spreading Bolshevism and the revolution through Europe.
Receiving this blunt declaration by rearming Germany as his farewell, Captain Anthony Eden, Great Britain's brilliant young Lord Privy Seal, enduring Minister of Peace, leaves Berlin for Moscow, where this week Soviet Foreign Commissar Maxim M. Litvinov welcomes him at a great diplomatic dinner, proposes a toast.
I lift my glass to the health of His Majesty, the King of England, and to the prosperity and happiness of the British people.
Thus, for the first time in Soviet history, a member of the communistic Soviet government on Soviet soil drinks the health of George V, imperialistic king of the capitalistic Great Britain, as the Soviet band plays God Save the King. Next day, as the world watches closely to see how closely England will cooperate with Russia, archenemy of capitalism, Commissar Litvinov takes Captain Eden to the somber Kremlin, presents him to Joseph Stalin. This week, the world learns what happened behind those locked doors. Russia's swarthy, hulking dictator, as always, opening the discussion with the shrewd courtesy of a question.
Tell me, Captain Eden, what is your opinion of Adolf Hitler?
My conference with Herr Hitler in Berlin convinced me of his sincerity, Mr. Stalin. I believe he believed what he said to me. But I do not feel that Herr Hitler is either reasonable or open to reason.
Captain Eden's talk with Herr Hitler has shown that Europe's danger spots are at last located and clearly defined.
What do you think is the danger of war today as compared with 1914?
I believe the danger is definitely less now than it was then.
I hope you are right, Captain Eden. But I fear I cannot agree with you. In my opinion, the danger today is much greater. In 1914, there was only one nation whose ambition to expand created war. In 1935, there are two such nations, one in Europe, the other in the Far East, Germany and Japan.
And Russia lies between them.
Captain Eden, Germany is in a highly dangerous state of mind. We must take precautions.
Precautions? Yes. But first and most important is the peace of Europe. My government stands against any policy of surrounding Germany with a ring of hostile powers.
What then does England propose, Captain Eden?
A new all-European security pact in which any nation which breaks over her boundaries as an aggressor shall be punished by all others. Germany shall have the same opportunity as any other nation to sign the pact.
There, in that map on the wall, Captain Eden, Europe. Your British Isles, they are small in size. Yet today you hold the destinies of peace or war. You have the power to say whether or not ambitious schemes of conquest shall be checked.
Mr. Stalin, from Moscow I go to Poland, to Warsaw, and to Strada, where Italy, France, and England will confer. Am I to say to the other powers of Europe that Russia favors an openly united front against Germany, or a general security pact to include Germany?
Captain Eden, Russia will join England in the general security pact to include Germany.
Thus, for the first time since the fall of Tsar Nicholas, Russia and England are in accord on European policy. As dapper, youthful British diplomat Eden boards his train for Warsaw, a Bolshevik military band plays the Internationale and God Save the King. Then, with characteristic Russian humor, a selection that typifies the USSR's attitude toward rearmed Germany. With the big bad wolf as his send-off from Moscow, peacemaker Eden proceeds to Poland, whose leaders, fearing Germany more than they fear Russia, refuse to commit themselves to the Eden peace plan. Captain Eden returns to London for final conferences before proceeding next week to Stresa for the climax of the desperate new European peace roundup. And this week, from Italy's Benito Mussolini, comes his forecast on the Stresa conference.
Stresa will be a fixed point in European post-war politics, the end of the dangerous utopias of disarmament. The conference may establish between England, France, and Italy a common line of action in the face of such eventualities as warfare. But many people believe that from Stresa will come the salvation of humanity, a miracle to end a nightmare. Do not be deceived. Stresa will not be a millennium.
Time marches on. San Jose, California. In the courtroom where David Lamson is on trial for murdering his wife, a crucial question arises one day this week. The walls of the bathroom where Mrs. Lamson died were spattered with blood. Could the blood spurt 6 or 8 feet when, as the husband claims, she had cut the back of her head in falling on the edge of the tub? Or, as the prosecution contends, did the blood get on the walls as Mr. Lamson repeatedly struck the back of his wife's head with an iron pipe? Climax of this sixth week of Lamson's second trial comes when Dr. Clement H. Arnold, San Francisco physician whose hobby is murder evidence, is called to the witness stand by the prosecution.
Dr. Arnold, will you outline in your own words the tests which you made and their results?
Certainly. So far as I know, no one has ever made any real experiments to discover the distance which human blood will spurt of its own force from a severed artery. So I decided to find out for myself. I first had the back of my neck shaved. Then, to raise my blood pressure, I ate a large meal, drank many cups of coffee, and smoked several cigarettes. Finally, I went with a professional photographer to the office of a friend, a surgeon, and prevailed upon him to make a...
Well, Dr. Arnold, you're sure you want to go through with this? I'm ready to inject the anesthetic.
Go right ahead. You better get your camera ready, Hardacre.
About set now.
How's my blood pressure, Doctor?
Still well above normal.
All right. Just follow my directions.
Feel the surgical tray over here, Miss Thompson. Spread out that oil cloth behind the chair.
Yes, sir.
I'm ready, Dr. Arnold.
I'll first make a lateral, horizontal incision in the back of my neck, about 1.5 inches long, over the occipital artery.
Right. Large scalpel mesh.
And lay bare the occipital artery.
Gauze, please. All right.
Put a clamp on the artery.
Clamp, nurse.
And sever the artery.
Small scalpel, please. All right, Dr. Arnold.
Ready to take your pictures, Hardacre?
All set, Doctor.
Start your camera. Now, release the clamp. Hold back the edges of the flesh and let the blood spurt free. Try it in all directions. Compress the end of the artery. Now let the flesh close and allow the blood to flow free a moment. Got those pictures, Hardacre?
Yes.
All right. That's all.
Your Honor, this is Dr. Arnold's test in evidence. Leave with your testimony, please, Doctor.
It is thus proven that the blood from this artery, under any conditions, would not spurt more than 6 inches vertically or 18 inches laterally. And in a normal cut, where the edges of the wound do not gape, the blood would well out rather than spurt.
Then do you believe the stains on the bathroom wall could have come merely from the wound caused by Mrs. Lamson's falling against the tub, as the defense contends?
That is impossible.
Thus, by boldly experimenting upon his own person, Dr. Arnold throws a bombshell into the defense counsel's case in the long-drawn-out Lamson trial, furnishes important data for future criminal prosecution. Time marches on. Scottsboro, Alabama. Through four bitterly controversial years to a climactic decision this week, goes a case which began in the crowded, stuffy Scottsboro courtroom in April of 1931.
My name is Virginia Pike, Your Honor. On Wednesday, March 25th, I jumped a freight train at Chattanooga with my girlfriend, Ruby Bates. There were some white boys in one end of the car. Then these nine Negroes climbed into the car. They threw the white boys off the train. One of the Negroes picked me up in his arms and flung me back in the gondola. I struggled and hollered and screamed. They put their hands over my face and held a knife to my throat.
You are not trying whether or not these defendants are white or black. I don't want a verdict based on racial prejudice. But on the evidence, gentlemen of the jury, there can be but one verdict.
We find the nine defendants guilty of charge and fix the punishment of death in the electric chair.
With the Alabama court's conviction of the nine Negro boys, the Scottsboro case is appealed to higher courts on the grounds that the Negroes did not receive a fair trial. From a sordid little jury case, it swiftly becomes a nationwide issue. Then, from Ruby Bates, one of the two girls involved, comes new testimony.
Virginia Price put me up to saying what I did. The whole thing was a frame-up. What really happened is the railroad detectives took us off a freight train and brought us to the jail. There was a big mob outside the jail. Virginia and I could hear them yelling and shouting like
water. Virginia, what's going to happen to us? I'm scared.
Don't worry, honey. Just do like I tell you and everything will be all right.
What have I got to say?
Just tell him you was attacked by those Negroes on the train.
That's a lie.
I can't say that.
You gotta. If you don't, they'll give you a long sentence in jail for vagrancy.
They're bringing the colored boys up here.
Don't you forget what I told you.
Get in there, you old hurry up.
Don't hit me no more, boss. Please don't hit me no more.
Now, Virginia. Are these the Negroes that attacked you?
Yes, sir, Sheriff. They're the ones that done it.
We never seen these jails on a train before.
Keep your mouth shut. Now, Ruby, you was on that freight train, wasn't you?
Yes, I was.
And did you see these Negroes?
Yes, I did.
Can you pick out the exact ones that done it?
I don't know,
Ruby.
Wasn't it these boys?
Yes.
That's better. Now, are you boys going to tell the truth?
We ain't guilty, boss. No, we ain't.
You want me to give you to that mob out there?
First of all, no. Please don't do that. Please.
Then will you tell the truth?
It will, sir. Wait on it.
With Ruby Bates thus directly refuting the testimony of Virginia Price, public opinion flares up anew, sharply divides North and South. Violently partisan books, plays, and articles appear as the case drags through appeal after appeal. The U.S. Supreme Court rules that the Scottsboro boys did not have proper defense lawyers. They are retried and again sentenced to death. Then once more the case comes before the United States Supreme Court, this time on the fundamental issue which affects all Southern justice, the issue of Negroes serving on juries. Manhattan criminal lawyer Samuel S. Leibowitz presents the new evidence before Justice Charles Evans Hughes and his eight associates.
Your Honor, I hold up before you these books containing the grand jury roll for Jackson County at the time of the trial of the defendant. Names of Negroes appear on the jury roll, but I can prove that the names were added after the defendants had been indicted by a grand jury made up exclusively of whites. Why were these books tampered with? The motive was to make absolutely certain that those colored boys died in the electric chair. There is no question but what these names are forgeries.
Page boy.
Yes, sir?
Bring that jury book up here to the bench and pass me my reading glass.
Yes, sir. You are.
Look at this, Justice Vandalander. Mr. Knight.
Yes, Your Honor?
You're the Attorney General of Jackson County, Alabama. Can you tell me that these names are not forged and that these jury rolls have not been tampered with?
Why, I don't know, Your Honor. I can't answer yes or no. But even if there have been, the jury commission in Alabama has the supreme power to decide who's to serve on a jury.
Not under the laws of the United States, Mr. Knight.
The U.S. Supreme Court renders its decision.
Whenever all persons of the African race are excluded solely because of their race or color from serving as grand jurors in the criminal prosecution of a person of the African race, the equal protection of the laws is denied to him, contrary to the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. This court, therefore, reverses the judgment of conviction in the cases of this Negro boy.
Thus, this week, the Scottsboro death sentences are overturned. But its essential problem, the South's most vexing social question, is no nearer final solution. In the current book, Stars Fell on Alabama, Carl Carmer, reporting the insoluble dilemma of the South, quotes an intelligent Southerner's comment on the Scottsboro case.
I might have been for acquitting those Scottsboro Negro boys at the first trial. But now all this stink's been raised, we've got to hang them. That probably shocks you a bit. But listen to this. A few months ago, three girls I knew were driving down the mountain near the Birmingham Country Club. A Negro with a shotgun steps out of the bushes and holds them prisoner while he talks to them about how white folks oppress the colored people. When it begins to get dark, he shoots all three of them. Two of them dead. Now, that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for this Scottsboro business, and I'm foreseeing that it doesn't happen again. I'll admit to you I'm snob enough not to have cared much about whether these Scottsboro boys were guilty or not. Those white wenches in that boxcar didn't mean a thing to me. But when it's a girl I know, one I have danced with and played tennis with, I'll be the first to put my hand on the rope. It's a hell of a mess, and I'm mighty sorry for those Scottsboro boys. But they've got to burn in the electric chair.
Alabama's prosecutor Knight states he will immediately begin a new trial of the Scottsboro Negroes. But the nation wonders what he can do to break the fundamental deadlock between the U.S. Constitution and the traditions of the Old South. A Negro has never served on an Alabama jury. If Alabama continues to exclude Negroes, the Scottsboro convictions and any convictions involving colored defendants are certain to be reversed immediately by a higher court. If Negroes do serve and vote for their own race, it means endless hung juries and no decision. Observers fear that with strict enforcement of the Supreme Court's ruling of this week, Southern court justice will be hopelessly deadlocked, and old Southern mob justice will take its place with the grisly wake of lynching, burning, and terrorism in the Southern states. Time marches on. City, on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House.
Now, football day. So tonight we're giving party out here with all the box office appeal of college football day. Your sports announcer, Raven Knight, in the lineup, Eddie Johnson playing County Yard number one, Dick Finelli playing County Yard number two, Helen Jepson playing Ned at number three, and Larry Tibbetts playing Silvio. The opera company is coming out of the huddle. Now they get in position, and the battle is on.
Oh, Colombia,
Wait a minute, folks. Johnson is out of the game for holding. He held a quarter note for 3 beats.
Deep in the shadow of his box, sits one man who does not laugh with the glittering crowd. Last night of the Metropolitan's 1935 opera season. And the early burlesque he has seen on so many last nights before. But for him, this is the last night of last night. His quiet, bearded old Giulio Gattica-Zazza, who after 27 years as manager of the Metropolitan Opera, this year retires. With a grave smile, he watches tiny soprano Lily Pond, an acrobatic act with huge tenor Lawrence Melchior. Here's Lawrence Tibbet inside the big red dragon recite nonsense first. Then, to end the performance, comes a serious note. On the stage screen appears a moving picture, the only one ever taken in the Metropolitan. The March of Time's portrayal of Gatti in his office and backstage on his opening night this season. The audience watches the old impresario on the screen, pensively listening to the so familiar music. Sadly, reminiscently shuffling through old photographs of his opera's great singers through 27 years. Pensive now in his dark box, as he watches the picture end, Gatti hears the orchestra strike up. Here's the audience standing all together, bid him final farewell.
I am sad to go. I have been here a long time. 27 years. 27 good years. Geraldine Farrar. She was one of the greatest. There was something about her, something communicative and exciting. And Caruso, a personality simple and magnetic. Of music, today we need a Verdi, a Wagner. A Wagner that is asking too much, perhaps. But one must pray. This seeking perfection is a hard thing. I am, yes, tired and old now. I shall spend the rest of my life in Italy, high on the hill above my Lake Maggiore, listening to the songs of my Italian blackbirds.
Time marches on. You have just listened to The March of Time, the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week, presented to you by the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine. Latest news on the thrilling new venture of the editors of Time.
The March of Time on the screen. The reception of The March of Time by the American theater-going public in the past 2 months has been exciting and gratifying to us. And it has also been a challenge. The second issue now showing is better than the first. The third issue now making must and will be better than the second. Our continuing purpose, to bring to the screen not only the drama of world events, but to show you what happens. And probing deeper, tell how it happens and why.
High point of the second issue. The breaking of the biggest news story of the month, the rearmament of Germany 3 days before the story swept the front pages of the world's newspapers.
In theaters all over the country, the German sequence brought boos, hisses, and cheers and applause. For The March of Time is not ordinary moving picture entertainment. It is the picturization of men you hate or fear or admire or pity, performing their vital roles in today's history.
You can see The March of Time at the theaters of these chains throughout the country. Lowe's in New York and 40 other U.S. cities, Holeye's in New England, Shea's Buffalo Theaters and the Smalley Houses of Upper New York State, the Warner Group in Philadelphia, and the Harris Amusement Company of Western Pennsylvania. In the Middle West, The March of Time is showing at the Balaban Katz chain at Chicago, the Public's Great States Theaters in Indiana and Illinois, the Burger Cephas Group in Minnesota, and the tri-state circuit of Iowa, Nebraska, and Illinois. The march of time is to be seen in the far west and the Fox West Coast and evergreen state chains throughout Montana, California, Oregon, and Washington, the public Salt Lake in Idaho and Utah, and the Huffman Theaters at Denver. In the south, the Sanger chain in Alabama, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana, the Kinsey Group in North and South Carolina and Virginia, the Wometco Circuit in Florida, and the Interstate Theaters in Texas and New Mexico. The Canadian Famous Players Theater chain is exhibiting the march of time coast to coast in Canada. If the march of time is not being shown in the theater near you, how can your local theater obtain it?
No community need be without the march of time. It is sold independently of any other product, and a fair national price policy has now been worked out for every size, city, town, and theater. Suggest to the manager of your theater that he wire collect to March of Time distributors. Address Radio City, New York. We will send him within 24 hours complete information on how he can secure this new screen feature.
The March of Time, untuned to yesterday from April 5th, 1935 on CBS. Harry Von Zell serving as announcer with Westbrook Van Voorhees. Reportedly, the program also served as a vehicle for Orson Welles to try out his chops on the air. This is an hour of true history, untuned to yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for a broadcast of That Was the Year, syndicated in 1935, focusing in on the year 1924.
The year, recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
1924, that was the year.
I don't think the leases will be canceled. They're perfectly legitimate. I have no money invested in the Teapot Dome, and I have nothing in common with Mr. Sinclair. We are just friendly business rivals, that's all.
This was the statement of oil magnate Edward L. Doheny on his way to appear before the committee of the U.S. Senate investigating his loan of $100,000 to Albert B. Fall, former Secretary of the Interior in the administration of President Harding. The next day in Washington, D.C., under the heavy questioning of Senator Thomas J. Walsh, said Doheny,
Mr. Fall has been keeping my name out of the discussion for the reason that a full statement might be misunderstood. I wish to inform the committee that on the 30th of November, 1921, I loaned to Albert B. Fall $100,000 upon his promissory note to enable him to purchase a ranch in New Mexico. This sum was loaned to Mr. Fall by me personally.
June 5. Albert B. Fall, Harry F. Sinclair, Edward L. Doheny Sr., and his son Edward L. Doheny Jr. are indicted in the District of Columbia Supreme Court. Fall, Sinclair, and Doheny Sr. charged with conspiracy. Fall and the two Doheny's charged with bribery.
April 3, 1925. These indictments are dismissed on a technicality. But on May 27 of the same year,
new indictments are returned, resulting in dismissal or acquittal for all save the former cabinet member. On October 25, 1929, Albert B. Fall was found guilty of having accepted a bribe, sentenced to a year in jail, and fined $100,000. After delays, Fall went to jail in 1931 to be released for good behavior in May 1932. A broken, dispirited old man.
February 18, 1924.
Under fire of the Teapot Dome government leases inquiry, Secretary of the Navy Edwin L. Denby resigned, saying to President Calvin Coolidge in his letter,
I fear my continuance in office would increase your embarrassment.
Another national scandal in 1924.
As a result of financial wizardry surrounding the American Metal Company, a New York grand jury returned an indictment against Harry M. Doherty, charging that he had conspired
to defraud the United States of its governmental functions and rights and of his honest, impartial, and unprejudiced services and judgment as Attorney General.
March 28, 1924.
My dear Mr. President, I hereby acknowledge receipt of your letter of March 27th by the hand of your secretary requesting my resignation as Attorney General of the United States. Solely out of deference to your request and in compliance therewith, I hereby tender my resignation. I most respectfully request that it become effective herewith. Signed, H.M. Doherty, Attorney General.
At Atlantic City, New Jersey, the same day, said Doherty to reporters,
I'm carefree and happy. Right at this minute, I should rather be in Atlantic City than in office. I haven't any plans for the immediate future. I don't need any. Harry M. Doherty is a man who can form his plans rapidly as the occasion arises.
Here's some more telegrams, Mr. Doherty.
Oh, thank you, lad. Oh, now, let me see. I don't think I've got any change for a tip.
Here, Mr. Doherty, let me...
No, thank you. I prefer to keep the loans in the family. I'll borrow a quarter from my son-in-law.
Brought to trial, Harry M. Doherty was freed after the jury had deliberated 66 hours and disagreed.
1924, that was the year.
Sunday, February 3, Washington, D.C. Before a modest house on S Street is huddled a group of 200 men, women, and children, peering in anxious silence at the front door. At about 11:20 a.m., the door opens slowly, quietly. A gaunt, haggard man appears, stands with bended head.
Say, that's Dr. Grayson, Mr. Wilson's physician.
I must tell you that Woodrow Wilson is gone. He passed away in his sleep just a few moments ago. The end came peacefully. A bulletin will be issued shortly.
A few days later, the wartime president of the U.S., Woodrow Wilson, was buried in the great Episcopal Cathedral in the nation's capital.
...1924, that was the year...
...that the $2 billion soldiers bonus bill was passed by both houses of the U.S. Congress... ...over President Coolidge's veto.
That was the year...
...that an uprising in the small town of Lilly, Pennsylvania... ...gave vent to a battle between residents and a mob of 500... ...from a neighboring town... ...wearing the full ceremonial robes of the Ku Klux Klan.
That was the year...
...that the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VIII... ...later the Duke of Windsor... ...thrilled young American feminine hearts... by his visit to the U.S.
That was the year...
that 19 nations competed in the 8th Olympic Games... held near Paris, France. The final point scores...
First, the United States, 94.
Second, France, 64. Third, Sweden, 44 and one-half.
Fourth, Great Britain, 41 and one-half.
Fifth, Finland, 34.
Greatest heroes of the 1924 Olympic Games... were the trio from Finland... Nurmi, Ritola, and Stenroos... who between them won every long-distance race... including the marathon.
That was the year.
February 12. In the Valley of the Kings near Luxor, Egypt, about 20 men, begrimed by desert dust and the sweat of toil, stand deep in a two-year-old excavation. The heavy lid of an oblong box is being raised. Slowly, cautiously, tediously. The man directing operations is noted Egyptologist Howard Carter. At last, he removes his cork helmet and speaks.
There. That's quite high enough. Well, all I see here is a charred piece of cloth. Do I have your permission, sir, to remove this?
As Secretary of State of Egypt, I grant you permission, Mr. Carter.
Thank you. Oh, gentlemen, our search is ended. Oh, how I wish Lord Carnarvon were here. To his memory really belongs the credit. Gentlemen, for 3,300 years, within this stone sarcophagus has rested the body of Egypt's boy pharaoh, Tutankhamun.
And we may wonder whether or not the smile upon the golden countenance of Egypt's young king was in warm appreciation for the familiarity with which English-speaking peoples welcomed him home. Whether or not he would have replied... had we called him by his Tin Pan Alley nickname, King Tut.
1924, that was the year...
that two figures in the world of writing, two figures in the world of sports, two figures in the show world, and one figure in the world of labor, died.
In the world of letters...
Francis Hogden Burnett, author of Little Lord Fauntleroy, and Laura Jean Libbey, writer, among others, of Miss Middleton's Lover, or Potted on their bridal tour.
In the world of sports...
famous Harvard football coach, Percy D. Houghton... and the grand old man of the turf, Pop Gears.
In the show world?
American dean of minstrelsy, Lou Dockstader. And prolific composer of light operatic literature, Victor Herbert.
And in the world of labor?
President of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers.
1924, that was the year...
that two American multimillionaires announced on the same day huge donations in the interest of higher education.
Charlottesville, North Carolina.
James B. Duke, tobacco king and developer of water power systems in the Carolinas... created a trust fund to eventually amount to $40 million for charitable, religious, and educational purposes. Thereupon, Trinity College in Durham, North Carolina, became Duke University, received $16 million.
Rochester, New York.
George Eastman, Camera King, announced the donation of $15 million to educational institutions and said,
I am upwards of 70 years old and feel that I would like to see results from this money within the natural term of my remaining years. One of the reasons why I welcome this disposition of my Kodak stock is that it separates me from money-making for myself and will give me the benefit of a somewhat more detached position in respect to human affairs.
The four institutions of higher learning benefiting through Eastman's donation were the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the University of Rochester, Hampton Institute, and Tuskegee College.
That was the year.
You were reading Michael Arlen's sensational The Green Hat, The Green Bay Tree by Louis Bromfield, and Edna Ferber's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, So Big.
1924, that was the year.
That stage successes included Outward Bound with Alfred Lunt and Leslie Howard, The Beggar on Horseback, What Price Glory, George Kelly's The Show Off, and George Arliss in Old English.
That was the year.
That box office successes of the screen were The Thief of Baghdad, The Ten Commandments, The Seahawk, and Monsieur Bouquet.
And that was the year.
That music counters everywhere sold thousands of copies of one of your perennial favorites.
Since you've gone away, one thing is clear to me. You were dearer than dear to me. From the moment you fade.
By your side, I learned to love the night. But the loveliness of the night.
That was the year on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated recording from 1935. We now wrap up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday with a broadcast of Adventures in Research with an episode called The Perfect Clock from February 11th, 1947, a syndicated broadcast.
Adventures in Research. Paul Shannon, transcribing another tale of science by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer at the Westinghouse Research Laboratory. A story of the perfect clock. The year is 1700, the age of exploration. Seafaring men are subduing the terrors of the unknown reaches of ocean, charting new maps where once were only expanses of unknown, and ever pushing back the unplumbed vistas, where once only the legendary sea monsters lurked. But there was danger, constant danger, in the strange, unknown reaches of all the sea.
Rollins! Rollins! Try not to put the look on the sea. Who can see anything in this storm is beyond me. 23 years of sailing and never a storm as bad as this. 3 miles off our course.
We have calculated our position as east of Barton's Point. But there's no sign of a lighthouse, Captain.
Calculate! Calculate! Who can chart the skies with this watch? What good are the figures when we don't know the hour? What good is anything? What? Hold it! See that? That flash of lightning? I thought. Can't be that far off our course. It's impossible. Couldn't have been the Great Reef. It couldn't have been. We can just ride out this storm until daylight.
Watch out for the wind!
And Lloyd's of London tolls the bell for another ship lock. Lost with all hands on board, the jagged fingers of the Great Reef. What good are lighthouses, or charts, or calculations, when the storms can blind and blot the best of man-made navigation? Old seafaring men scanned the skies for favorable signs, muttered seamen's shanties to bolster their courage. But the King of England scanned more than skies. He scanned the minds, the finest scientific minds of the empire, for an answer.
Sir Isaac, the future of English exploration is at stake.
I've heard the news, Majesty. The
Central at last moment.
That's five ships in less than a fortnight. I've called on you because you're a scientist. What do these ships need?
What do they need?
A clock. A clock? These ships have timepieces, the best that can be made.
Not good enough, Your Majesty. To determine the ship's longitude, the navigator must time the moon's journey through space. Imagine the moon at the center of a circle, and the Earth on the edge of the circle. You see that a very slight error in the distance traveled by the moon would make a very large error here on the Earth. What these ships need is a clock better than...
Then why haven't we one?
Your Majesty, there are certain factors to be considered. The variables. Motions of the ship. Changes in temperature and climate. Difference in gravity of the latitude. 101 variable factors that can't...
I am not interested in variables. I am interested in a timepiece. To the man who makes an accurate watch, I will give £20,000.
£20,000 for a perfect watch.
Cool. Even Christopher Wren had a try at it. He might have built St. Paul's, but he couldn't build a clock to suit him.
Year after year went by, and the Royal Board of Longitude inspected effort after effort. But no clock measured up to the standards. No clock passed the test. No clock could conquer the variable.
The blooming Board of Longitude will be hanging on to the money wire till the River Shannon flows backwards.
10 long years passed, marked by the tolling of the bell, counted off on reefs and strands, checked by the crack of a hull, the splintering of a prow, and the shroud-like fog that covered all.
Crikey, who can invent a perfect clock anyhow?
Who? A man named John Harrison, barely able to read, who could write little more than his own name. Son of an illiterate carpenter, he could invent a perfect clock. He was so convinced of it, he sold his carpenter shop and by 1728 was ready to submit the results of his work to the Astronomer Royal.
You see, Sir Thomas, this is what I call the compensation pendulum. As you're aware, sir, all metals contract with cold and expand with heat. The ordinary pendulum now in use grows longer in hot weather, shorter in cold. That makes the clock undependable. But all metals do not contract and expand at the same rate. So I built this pendulum of two different metals, steel and brass. A bar of steel, a bar of brass, and a bar of steel. So, as you see, the metal that expands the faster is counteracted by the metal that expands the slower. I've kept such a pendulum in my house for years. The clock has not varied so much as a minute.
Sir Thomas Halley, Britain's Astronomer Royal, looked with favor on the doughty ex-carpenter's weird idea. And John Harrison went home to build a clock and apply to the Board of Longitude for the £20,000. 7 years of hammering, tinkering, taking odd jobs to get the money to live and buy materials, learn new skills. All for a perfect timepiece to frighten the fog, cheat the oceans, and win...
£20,000.
And so it came to pass in 1735 that eager, unlearned John Harrison, son of an illiterate carpenter, went before the Board of Longitude to demonstrate his perfect clock, the chronometer. And the Royal Society said...
Extraordinary. And this spring here, Doctor, is another compensation. As you know, when you wind a watch, the mechanism stops during the process of winding. So this extra spring I've added keeps the clock working while you wind it. It loses no time. Extraordinary. I know, Doctor, the chronometer will work at sea. I've had it set in a special frame and tried it on a seagoing barge. It worked accurately.
The principles of this invention promise a great measure of accuracy. I will give you... a certificate to that effect, signed by myself.
A certificate? But what about the £20,000?
My good man, the Board of Longitude has seen hundreds of clocks and boxes and timepieces and chronometers. Many of them had merit. We'll have to see if yours can pass the test. And then perhaps... yes.
Really quite a...
On board the HMS Oxford, one of His Majesty's warships, went the framed and begadgeted timepiece, ready to prove or disprove the years of work by the amateur inventor. The sea was calm, the skies were fair, and what if the captain seemed a little indifferent? He had seen many of these metallic gewgaws taking their single voyage. The lookout cried,
"Land ahoy!"
And the captain smiled. It would be Star Point they were nearing. The figures of the navigator checked. Star Point it was, and...
I beg to differ with you, gentlemen, but my figures say it's not Star Point at all. It's Lizard Island we must be nearing.
The captain shrugged his shoulders. He could understand the little man's enthusiasm, but after all, he knew the ocean like...
the palm of my hand. And, good heavens, Newbury Lighthouse. By all that's holy, the man's right. We're coming to Lizard Island. We are 90 miles off in our reckoning. Harrison, when we reach port, I'll give you a letter outlining the success of this plot.
But the board had an objection.
Extraordinary, Mr. Harrison, but the chronometer is too unwieldy. Go home and build a smaller chronometer. This one is far too cumbersome. And by all means, consult us when you've completed it. Yes, do.
And 4 years later, Harrison had finished a smaller chronometer, but...
not quite right, Harrison. Suppose you try again. The theory is practicable, but you realize...
And 10 years after that, the plucky little man had built another. This time, he showed it to the Royal Society of Astronomers.
And as president of the Royal Society, I am pleased the machine invented by John Harrison works with a degree of exactitude that is astounding. I am proud to award the gentleman the highest prize we can bestow, the Royal Society Gold Medal.
Thank you. I hope the Board of Longitude will be as impressed as you have been.
What was it? In 1751...
The Board is making arrangements to test the chronometer.
And in 1756...
The board is making final arrangements.
And in 1761 came the news.
Father, it's a message for you from the Board of Longitude.
A plague take him. I won't listen to it.
But it's good news, Father. They say your chronometer will be tested on the Dorsetshire, bound for Jamaica, and back to England on the Deptford. They want you to be ready to sail in a fortnight.
Now they want me to be ready. After my waiting for them for how many years, I should be ready in a fortnight.
So John Harrison sent his oldest boy, William, on the journey. He sat at the window waiting for news of the Deptford. He'd waited a long time. He could wait a little longer, a little while longer. And finally, William returned with the good news that...
Father, the chronometer worked to perfection. It was tested by all the big scientists in London and found to be correct within 5 seconds.
5 seconds. 5 seconds. I suppose they'll want me to rebuild it again to make up for that 5 seconds.
They were all very pleased, Father. And they recommended to the Board of Longitude you be given the prize money.
And the Board of Longitude finally replied...
The Board of Longitude will take the matter under advisement.
But though the Board of Longitude was a bit forgetful, others were more appreciative of John Harrison's perfect clock.
Father, it's a letter with the Royal Seal from the King of Sardinia.
Read it, William. My eyesight has failed along with everything else,
oh,
I guess.
Father, you're not...
Yes, yes. I'm an old man with no spirit left in me. I've been a failure...
Listen,
and...
Father. It's an order from the King of Sardinia for 4 chronometers. He'll pay you £1,000 apiece.
Huh? A foreign country does that. And the contemptible Board of Longitude. Here, give me a paper in quill. I'll write to that Board of Longitude a letter that'll scorch their ears off. I'll tell them.
And this time the letter got results. The board sent Harrison half the prize and promised the rest if one more test was successful. This time the trial was made by the great explorer, Captain Cook, in his memorable voyage around the world. Cook reported to the Royal Society afterward.
Gentlemen, on this voyage, I have not only worked as navigator, but as mathematician and astronomer. I was invaluably aided in all this work by the wonderful instrument, the chronometer. Without it, I would have little of value to report to the scientific world.
And to patient John Harrison came one last bit of good news.
The Board of Longitude is sending the remainder of the £20,000 to John Harrison for his extraordinary invention. The Board of Longitude has worked diligently, unceasingly, and with all possible dispatch to discover the perfect clock. We trust we are not rash in deciding in favor of Mr. Harrison's chronometer.
The good doctor had no reason to fear the hasty decision. John Harrison's chronometer is still in working order today at Greenwich Observatory, while ships steer safely and surely because of John Harrison's achievement in science, his assurance of patience, his adventure in research. And that's today's story by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratory. Join us again next week for another transcribed story of science on Adventures in Research.
Adventures in Research, on Tuned to Yesterday from February 11th, 1947. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark the Villanier. Thanks for tuning in.